Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 12th of August, and this is Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and with me as ever is Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things with you?
Yeah, pretty good. Although, it could have been better. I woke up to the news this morning that we're officially in recession again, first time in 11 years, which was, not the best sort of news, although it didn't come as all that much of a surprise.
Not too much of a surprise, but I'm doing my best. I did my civic duty and had a pub lunch yesterday.
Good for you.
Rishi Sunak bought half of it for me, so thank you.
Good. He's a good lad. Well, look, let's not get distracted by little details like the collapse of the economy. Let's stick to our plan, because today we're delighted to welcome another guest to the podcast. He is engineer and businessman Kevin Lyons. Kevin is a director of London-based structural engineer Lyons O'Neill. The company undertakes a variety of projects across multiple sectors, from high-end private residential developments and large-scale commercial projects to education and leisure schemes. One of Lyons O'Neill's more interesting areas of expertise, from my point of view, is the conservation of historic buildings. But today we're going to focus on another topic, which is also, I think, close to Kevin's heart, and that's the question of prefabrication, or off-site manufacture, as it prefers to describe itself these days. First, welcome, Kevin. It's good to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you for inviting me on today. It's a pleasure to come on.
Not at all. I described you as a director earlier, but am I right in thinking that you're actually one of the co-founders of the business?
Yes. Yeah. I think we started up in the last recession. If you're talking about the recession, we started up the company in 2007. Thought, what's the worst going to happen? And then the recession
and,
happened.
Was it difficult getting it off the ground?
I think when you were small like that, you know, we've always had a variety of work. You know, we've never been in one particular sector, so we've been able to adapt and evolve. Yeah. You know, because the market has changed an awful lot in the last 15 years.
Indeed, the topic we're discussing today, or you know, one of the main topic we're discussing today, which is off-site manufacture, isn't actually a new thing. It's been around for a long, long time, and it's been very popular in certain areas for the last 20 years or so. It's been I've seen it described numerous times as the way to go for construction. It doesn't seem to have taken off the way people had hoped it would. But you know, what's your feeling about that?
I mean, it's interesting you say that. I think it's been a holy grail for an awful long time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Interestingly, we got involved in project in Lewisham, which was former LCC council housing, and it was a development that was built as part of the Homes for the Heroes after the First World War.
Oh yeah.
And you know, we discovered there was something really odd about these buildings, and it wasn't until we did a bit of research we realized they were all prefabricated buildings.
They just looked
like standard masonry buildings, but we thought, you know, these are moving in an odd way. And it was a well documented development, you know, back in the 20s and 30s, of which was another time of recession and hardship. So they were searching for cheap prefabricated buildings. Some of these buildings are steel frames. Some of them are tilt facades. You know, and there was even one that was what was it called? Factocrete. It was horsehair and concrete. So, you know, the desire to find a silver bullet, you know, this magic bullet to solve all our ills is not a new thing.
Because normally a South London prefab's easy to spot a mile away, isn't it?
They're
very distinctive. I mean, I'm not sure there are many of them left, they're not elaborate or sophisticated structures, are they?
These were built as, you know, traditional masonry, or to look like traditional masonry buildings. Huh? So, but they're
And they dated from how long ago?
20s, 30s. So it was a whole development. I think there was a number of them built post First World War. So, you know, it just shows you that, you know, this isn't a new thing. This is something that people have been trying to do for a long time.
Why isn't it the de facto sort of way to go now? Why are we still building on site with brick and block and all the rest of it?
I think we're probably getting a bit better at it. The ability for a bit more mass manufacture is helping. But, the bit I struggle with is future flexibility, and I think this, we've been building schools for, past 10 years or whatever. We've built a number of schools, and the question is now, are they fit for purpose? Crazy
how old are these? How old are these schools that we're already worried about them not being fit for purpose?
Some of them we're literally just finishing now, or some of them are being designed now because, the design guides are going to change, aren't they?
Are we talking COVID here?
Yeah, I'm talking COVID now.
Okay.
And there's no, the genie's out of the bottle with COVID. The genie's out of the bottle with working from home, and the whole working world is going to change, and so are schools. So buildings are going to have to respond. They're going to have to be flexible. And it's interesting because we talk a lot about embodied energy in buildings and reducing our emissions. And the more I think about it, reuse is the most important thing,
So do you think that prefabrication can help that, or does it make it more difficult? If you've got a volumetric modular building, you can't really change the modules that easily, can you?
Well, there's a significant difference between prefabrication and modularization, I think.
Right. Okay.
Modularization, I think, has its place, but I feel it's a very short-term solution because we're building. I see schools built that are modular, come in nicely under budget, built very quickly, low waste. But are we going to be knocking them down in 20 years?
Can we talk about definitions here, about the terms? Because you mentioned the distinction between modular and prefabricated, but it seems to me that there are all sorts of aspects of off-site construction, and a lot of them, as they say, not new. I mean, a high-rise modern office block is a steel frame erected on site, but the trusses are the girders are made somewhere else and shipped in, and then Meccano together on site, and then these curtain walling pieces which are made in a factory are placed on top to make the walls, and this is all familiar in structured SIPs, structurally insulated panels in big shed developments. That's all a prefabrication of a sort. And then you've got where all the big money's moving into, like L&G and Goldman Sachs and the Rubin brothers, who are building these factories to build, I think they're prefabricated, maybe they're modular, a finished house, either a finished house with a roof, four walls and a kitchen and a TV hanging on the wall, or maybe it's a flat pack house. Are they modular or are they prefab?
Well, modular comes in a module, basically, and it's all a function of what you can stick on the back of a lorry, really.
That's not very inefficient from the transport point of view,
no,
is it?
It's not.
Because you're basically carrying thin air around.
Yeah, exactly. And they're very good at stacking them. They become very efficient. But then you get onto panelized systems, which are modular of a sort, but they're not they're modular in the fact that they're a 3.6 high, that's the maximum they can go because of a lorry. And the length, there's module lengths, but it's not a volumetric thing, which is like a big, port cabin.
Oh, another piece of jargon.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, volumetric versus modular.
Well, I'd class a sort of porter cabin as a volumetric. But, panelised, CLT's panelised, but it's all prefabricated. But, you could say the same about steelwork. It's fabricated off-site, isn't it? In this country, we don't weld it together. We bolt it together.
One of the biggest objections, I think, whenever you mention off-site manufacture or prefabrication, people say is basically it's a production line. Obviously, one of the advantages of off-site is that you're making buildings in controlled factory conditions, which obviously has quality advantages.
Yeah.
But basically, it's a production line, so you're producing the same thing over and over again. There's no scope for originality or uniqueness or anything like that. And I know that you've said in the past that actually it's quite possible to introduce a bespoke element into prefabrication. Can you tell us something about that? I mean, are the two not mutually exclusive?
Well, no, I think that's probably the difference between prefabrication and, modularization. Yeah. If you're knocking out the same modules all the time, your efficiencies become from repetition, don't they? but it doesn't mean you can't prefabricate something that's unique. You know, prefabrication for me is about taking work off-site and reducing time on-site and, you know, contractors' prelims and stuff like that. And it's interesting whether the traditional main contractor model will work in that scenario. It's more about the quality of it, prefabrication, isn't it? You know, it's in a controlled environment by workers who know that product. So, you know, prefabrication and modularization are two completely different things.
Okay.
In my head.
In terms of building performance, are there any advantages that you can see to prefabrication, which, you know, any advantages it would have over traditional on-site construction?
I think that's the interesting tension with flexibility, because prefabricated structures, you know, let's talk about a cross-laminated timber building. You know, every element is working. It's a very efficient structure. You know, air tightness is really good, and it's a carbon sink as well. So there's lots of positives for it. But the reason there's lots of Victorian warehouses that are still around being used as offices is because there's a lot of redundancy in them. And they're very flexible buildings. And they've been able to be adapted over the years. Whereas a cross-laminated timber building, you know, you might not be able to take one of those walls out without introducing a whole new bit of structure to replace it. So they're not, you know, with the efficiency comes unadaptability, if that's a word.
Is that a price worth paying? The saving you might get up front in building it, when it comes to time to adapt it or get rid of it, it may not be quite as recyclable as brick and stone. You can't put an extension on it as easily if it's to be talking about housing. Is that initial cost saving worth it?
Well, it's worth it to the people who are building it, isn't it? You know, if we talk about education as a sector, it's been traditionally very ad hoc. You know, I mean, if you go to any school, they sort of grow sheds because, you know, they always want more storage. They always want a bit more of this. And the buildings are never what they exact, you know, they're never able to adapt the buildings. They're always extending them because it's a very difficult thing to predict. You know, and you know, unless you get some sort of cross-party sort of investment in it, it's always going to be what's the immediate issue cost of the moment sort of thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's always going to be quite reactive.
In terms of the house building industry, where I would have thought if you've got a large development and you've got Taylor Wimpey or Persimmon slapping several hundred houses on it, you'd think that off-site manufacturer might be the way to go. And I know that a lot of people in the house building industry have tried it, but they've also got huge quality problems, haven't they, house builders? I mean, the snagging lists, and you know, we read about it in the Daily Mail all the time, don't we, about Mr. and Mrs. Smith and the black mold in their bedroom and all the rest of it. Prefabrication surely should be able to solve problems like that. I'm surprised that the house builders aren't really going for it in a big way.
I'm sure there are a lot of success stories, but you don't hear about it in the news, do you? You don't hear the success stories and you don't hear the bad stories.
Do the volume house builders make a lot of use of prefabrication?
I think they're starting to, and the people are starting to set up. I must admit, it's not a sector that we really get too involved in. So I couldn't really say, but I've definitely seen modularised leisure building, you know, hotels and things that, you know, buildings like hotels, the sort of module for a hotel room hasn't really changed in however many years. So, you know, you can see why it works in that scenario. But those buildings, if they don't want to be a hotel in 20, 30 years, are going to struggle to be anything else.
Yeah. But here's the thing about all those things you've talked about, whether we're talking about hotels, leisure centres, schools, all of those things, no one's spending their more than their life savings, mortgaging themselves to a hilt and having to go to work day in, day out for 40 years in order to buy their house. It hasn't got a personal end customer who's invested in it. And therefore, it doesn't really matter that a Travelodge hotel, the rooms are a little bit antiseptic and plastic bathrooms and or fiberglass bathrooms or whatever. it doesn't really matter. As long as someone's prepared to pay the 100 quid a night or whatever it is to sleep there because they know it's going to be clean and it's going to be there. It seems to me that as soon as you start putting in, and I take your point that the housing market is the housing business is not your particular speciality, but it seems to me that that's where the whole dynamic starts to fall down.
Because of flexibility or...
Well, desirability. People actually don't want to live in it. All these modular houses that seem to be going up, whether it's modular or prefabricated or system build or whatever, it tends to be for the either student accommodation or buy-to-rent, rented sector, and so on. But if you ask some posh London developer why they're not using bathroom pods or you know, tin boxes stacked on top of each other...
Because it doesn't sell.
Exactly that. And the customer's always right.
Exactly. as we've said, I think that's the difference between volumetric and prefabrication. I think prefabrication is always going to be a good idea.
Kevin, give us an example of a really successful prefabrication project or technique. What really works?
Well, we've done a lot of cross-laminated timber buildings, and you know they've been very successful. I think
I just want to clarify, cross laminated timber, I think of it as being plywood basically. Is that too simplistic?
It's engineered timber basically. So you use lots of little bits of timber, stick it together and create a sort of manufactured product.
Are we talking board products or are we talking
if you imagine little battens of timber.
Okay.
Are basically cross-laminated, so they're laid across each other and then pressured with a bit of resin.
I think a flagship project of that isn't the new Canary Wharf station for is it Crossrail or the new Canary Wharf railway station?
I'm not too sure.
CLT.
I'm not too sure. Okay. There's the generic product, but then there's all the issues that go with it. I mean, this perception of timber, although it chars and you know it's very good in the fire scenario. But there's also, it's a European product. To my knowledge, there's not somewhere that makes it. I know there's a lot of people trying to do it, but there's nobody who makes it in this country. So it's all Euro-dependent. Quantity surveyors hate it because they can't get competitive prices on it. You know, you have to get into bed with a manufacturer. So there's lots of side issues that go with these. But as a product, you know, it's a panelised product and you can make those panels whatever you want.
And is it structural as well as...
Yeah, it's a structural product. You know, we've done schools out of them. We've just... And we also use it in a hybrid scenario as well. You know, it's a horses for courses thing. I mean, we did new first team facility down at Tottenham Hotspur's training ground. And they had a... what is effectively... You're not allowed to call it a hotel, although I just have on the podcast. It's a lodge for the players. Right. I called it, it's like stables for the racehorses. You know, it lent itself to a lot of repetition. And also we wanted a nice self-finishing structure. So, you know, we basically used the cross-laminated timber to form hotel rooms, you know, because the panel sizes, you know, the sort of spans of cross-laminated timber, it's good up to about, you know, sort of 4.5 metres, which is perfect for a sort of room size and things like that. So, you know, it was very successful in that scenario. The only problems were in pricing it and getting it here. But anyway, you know, I mean, that's a prefabricated project. But Philip, for me, steel's a prefabricated product. There's so many ways you can spin these arguments. If you talk to British Steel, as was, they would tell you that 5% of the steel in the sections you use today have been around since Roman times. Because it's a very recyclable product, but then you got to talk about the energy in recycling that product.
Yeah.
But surely reuse is the most important thing, you know?
Yeah.
Not knocking stuff down and building again is going to use less energy.
Yeah, I read recently that aluminium was the most, was the greenest construction material because it's infinitely recyclable. But I thought, think of the energy. I mean, just getting it out of the ground, getting it out of the bauxite, you know, it's there's a lot of embodied energy in there. So it's, as you say, you can spin this anyway.
It's an attitude, isn't it? I think, you know, to trying to reuse where you can. Reuse foundations if you can find out enough about them. Yeah. I mean, we recently did a project down in Plymouth, extending a building, and the original scheme was to basically drop a new building through the existing building.
Was this the old shopping centre there?
It was the old shopping centre down in Plymouth.
Yeah.
And I said to one of our associates, go down to Plymouth Building Control, and I bet there's such a major development, I bet they've got the drawings for it down there. So they went down there. We found all the original calculations, found out it had been designed for an extra couple of stories, and we were able to extend the building without put in just by putting new. The only new foundations we put in were because of the stability. We had to put new shear cores in.
Right.
But wow. You know, that attitude of no, come on, let's really try here.
Yeah,
not just putting new, that's fascinating. New structure in.
Yeah. Finally, let's talk about the prickly issue of whether we call it off-site construction or prefabrication, because I know that a lot of people really don't like to hear it described as an off-site building described as a prefab. I mean, it's definitely a not the way to describe it. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because of these old post-war prefabs in South London? People always think of those.
I think it's 100% that. You know, it's the porter cabin factor,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You can't call them porter cabins either because they don't like that.
Exactly. But it is, that's like a Hoover, isn't it? You know,
it's a vacuum. Yeah, exactly. But, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, no, I think it is. It's just a perception, isn't it? You know, prefabrication suggest cheap. But it isn't, it's built off-site or it's fabricated off-site.
Right. So what's the immediate future hold for Lyons O'Neill? What are you working on at the moment? Can you tell us anything about current projects?
I think like everyone, it's a bit of a mixed bag at the moment. But, we've got some cross-laminated timber projects at the moment. We've also got some looking at some big housing projects. But also schools as well, and the flexibility. I get torn between concrete and cross-laminated timber on some of these things because of the future flexibility and robustness of a frame. But we got a good variety of work on at the moment. But I think like everyone, it's been a tough few months.
No, it wasn't what we had you in to talk about particularly, Kevin. But you mentioned at the beginning something which is very interesting. I'd like to just. Before we finish, go back to it about because of COVID, you're worried that a lot of the school buildings that are being designed and built at the moment are not fit for purpose or already even before they're finished. Tell us a bit more. What's the future requirement? What should we be doing with school buildings?
Well, it is interesting because it's no different from our office. Our office is no longer fit for purpose.
You can send half your people to work from home, I guess.
The genie's out of the bottle, isn't it, with home working? We're never going to have the same working world, and that's going to have a dramatic effect on the office rental sector in London, for sure.
But there's a lot less demand for homeschooling, I think, than for
home
working. Exactly,
and also, children have got to go back to school, but we need more space, don't we? The social
You can't
distancing.
Cram people in the way we used
exactly.
to.
Exactly.
He's just saying they need to be bigger. They have to build bigger schools.
Yeah, maybe. Or there'll be more external space, that's used for teaching or, circulation may change. The one-way circulation make things untenable.
An awful lot of school buildings are flat roof. Is it feasible just to stick a few more porter cabins on top or another proper layer on top? Or are they so perfectly designed that, unlike your Plymouth shopping centre, they'll need to have new foundations?
They'll inevitably need to have new foundations. There's not that much load credit in a new building, especially for the loads that you get for a school. So, because the reality is that, again, there's that tension between trying to design a really efficient structure so you're not overusing materials. Or is your, it comes down to what your client, I always say in a meeting, you read the DFVE output specs and they say we want future flexibility, but then they talk about prefabrication and volumetric buildings. So they contradicts itself. We always say, look, you've got to have one key driver on a project and then everything else is a function of that, is subordinate to that key decision.
Right.
But the problem is everybody wants everything.
Yes.
And you can't have everything.
It just makes me think once again of our throwaway disposable society, that we think we're doing things really super, super efficiently, but, just like our cars that get scrapped after 10 years because they're so finely engineered, and in the old days you just sort of hit them with a hammer and a spanner and fix them.
Yeah.
Our buildings seem to be going the same way.
But they are, the model that people talk about is, the airline production and, the efficiency of buildings. Of the car manufacturing. But the problem is most buildings are bespoke. Every site's different. And that's why, we worked on a project probably about 20 years ago called the Optimum Sports Hall, which was the idea was Sport England were getting lots of designs put in, and there was good elements in all the designs, but what they wanted to do was bring them all together create a design for themselves that people bought, because 9 times out of 10 they were going on a green field, you know. So there weren't, the form of the building didn't have to adapt, you know. It was just
did they end up with a perfect camel?
They did end up with, but I think Sport England no longer existed or changed the way they operated, so it basically fell flat on its face. There were a number of them built, though. So, you know, there are types of buildings that can operate, but, you know, building in London, no site's the same.
No.
And the driver might be how you build the building. You know, you want elements in small pieces because you can only get them through that gap. So, you know, I think modularisation and large panelised buildings suit out London greenfield sites, but, you know, you're building in London and everything's bespoke.
Right, well, look, thanks ever so much, Kevin, for coming in and talking to us about that. It was a fascinating discussion.
It's been a pleasure.
Right, okay, so Phil, do you want to introduce the next topic? Because it's quite an interesting development for everybody in the construction industry. I think it's a change of direction by the government, or a slight change of direction by the government, at least. Tell us a bit about that.
Governments, this is the Planning for the Future consultation paper, white paper that was published last week. It's gone out for consultation. I think it's only about a 12-week consultation period. Now, governments forever have been trying to make the planning system more efficient. And the whole tension within this is that planning is inherently political. Local councils are elected to look after their local areas and to ensure appropriate development, make sure places don't get ruined for future generations and so forth. And there's always this tension that builders and developers want to build quicker. And on the whole, while some development are welcomed by local people, a lot of householders, it's called NIMBYism, and it's,
yes,
it
indeed,
makes it sound like a bad thing. But there are lots of things I don't want in my backyard, and I'm not unusual in that regard. And so it's up to the democratic process to weigh, measure, balance the countering needs and interests of the all parties involved. Now, the government, which despite being called a conservative government, it seems to be remarkably unconservative in what's proposing here. The main thrust is that they're proposing to split all the country. This is just England, by the way, because it's devolved. Planning powers are devolved in other parts of the United Kingdom.
Right.
In England, land would either be designated a growth area, which would automatically have outline approval in principle for anything you want to build, a renewal area, where there's a presumption in favour of development, but still slightly more hoops to jump through, and protected areas, essentially greenbelt, where you're not allowed to build anything, except you still will be able to negotiate that one as well.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, the reaction to it varies from the people who are trying to build houses in a line between Oxford and Cambridge, or they call it the arc, don't they, between Oxford and Cambridge, are saying that it doesn't go far enough. We should, you know, why can't we need to rip up the green belts? We should build on the green belts.
Yes.
Quote from one chap, green belts are still strangling our cities. And the continued refusal of the government to countenance freeing up the green belt for residential and commercial development risks stunting the growth of towns like and cities like Oxford and Cambridge. I think they would probably lose that vote if it came to a popular election.
I think so, because everybody's a NIMBY when it gets too close, aren't they?
Exactly that. The other part of this, the two other parts of this, which seem to be significant in the meat of this planning consultation paper, is a new system of, it used to be called planning gain, but basically Section 106 agreements and community infrastructure levy will be replaced with a new way of taking money off developers, which would be a fixed proportion of the value of development above a set threshold. So a small builder just building a few houses would be taken out of the equation.
No, so wouldn't have to build a leisure centre.
I don't know what the threshold is. I have to go back to play, but I don't know. I suspect a leisure centre would be big enough would be over the threshold. But I don't know. It depends how big the leisure centre is, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And the other, I mean, it's a long document. This, it's on the government website, gov.uk. Have a look at it. Planning for the Future. But the other thing is, it brings forward the proposals. And we've talked about this before. Fast track for beauty. The idea that this university philosopher, Roger Scruton, who headed this committee that was set up by government, who died just before it was published, the Building Better, Building Beautiful Commission. A part of this planning paper, it's chicken and egg, not chicken and egg, carrot and a stick, I guess. On the one hand, Johnny homeowner who's worried about his local area, her local area, being bespoiled by masses of houses being built. The flip side of that, the Housing Secretary, Robert Jennings, saying, well, that may happen, but these houses will be beautiful.
Yeah.
They'll all have trees and they'll all be designed. You'll have is it called the circus? The Crescent, the Royal Crescent in Bath.
Oh, yes.
Will be springing up. We'll have a country full of Poundburys springing up everywhere. And it'll all be,
well,
all
that
be
was that's what immediately sprung to mind to me, because I think, going back to the actual this proposal about the presumption in favour of development, I actually think is probably a good idea, because I think if you've already identified a site and classified it and basically agreed with the local population that this is a site that could withstand some development, then I think that a presumption in favour is fairly logical. And
but
of course,
you wouldn't have a presumption in favour. They already have a presumption. I mean, 9 out of 10 planning permissions get given.
Yes, that's right.
If you put in a planning permission for anything, there is a presumption that it's going to happen, because 9 out of 10 get approved. And there've been more than 1 million homes have been given planning permission that have yet to be built in the last 10 years. So I actually don't think getting planning permission is particularly the problem.
No, I think that moving on to the question of the beauty is so subjective. I don't know how you can police something like this, because, you know, one person's carbuncle is another person's sort of glamorous, sparkling new building, isn't it?
There's no reference to this in the actual consultation paper, but some friend of the Secretary of State or some such, or sources, briefed one of the friendly Sunday papers, I think it was, probably the Sunday Telegraph, that what he was thinking of was that to encourage the use of the local architectural vernacular, that local developments would have to use local stone, which it is lovely. I mean, you know, Kentish buildings built of Kentish ragstone, and the Yorkshire Dales using Kilnsey limestone or whatever. And this is a fine idea, but I don't quite know how they square that with the big push and drive and encouragement for modular. I'm going to learn from Kevin Lyons. I'm not to call it prefabricated housing. It's volumetric or modular housing. These factory-built kits or factory-built finished houses, they're not going to be using Yorkshire limestone or Cotswold sandstone or Kentish ragstone. They're going to be using imported panels or laminated timber.
But they might be covering it with little sort of slivers of the
pebble
local stone. An example not too far away from where I live, I think it's one of the best examples of this, is Bath, where there are very strict planning. I don't know if they still are. I haven't looked into the current planning regulations in Bath. But, you know, if you built something in Bath, it had to be built out of Bath stone. And, of course, but there are some really ugly modern buildings in Bath which are built out of what appears to be reconstituted Bath stone. And it just looks like a really half-hearted attempt to, or a reluctant confirmation to the local requirements. It doesn't work, basically. And there are modern buildings which would look actually better in brick or rendered finish or something like that. And I think that if you lay down strict rules like that, then
It does curtail imagination and creativity, doesn't it?
Yeah. But also, you cannot please everybody all the time. And if somebody says, we're going to build a beautiful development of new housing next to you, you can bet your bottom dollar that several people living in the next street will say that this isn't beautiful at all. They won't like it, not because of its appearance, it's because of its proximity. And they might even believe that it doesn't look nice. You know, you can't determine what people are going to consider to be beautiful and ugly. You build it the best way you can, you design it the best way you can, you build it, and then you hope that people like it.
Which is why so many houses are lowest common denominator Lego box designs.
Exactly.
Cause least offence to the fewest number of people.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Well, we'll see in due course where this planning paper leads us. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if it gets substantially watered down, because it's such a thorny subject, the world of planning. In the words of Sir Humphrey Appleby, it is a brave decision by any minister to take it on.
Yes.
Just briefly, one completely different story, which I put up on constructionindex.co.uk yesterday, which I think is a tale of our times, basically. A plant hire company, Ardent Plant Hire, is offering its customers that you can pay extra if you want to offset your air miles, your carbon footprint of the machine that you're renting. For a few extra pounds a week, you can offset your carbon usage. Ardent, to its credit, has put its money where its mouth is, and itself paid to offset the carbon footprint, 3,600 tons of CO2 produced a year by its 55 HGVs, and it's 22 grand to an organisation called Climate Care. This Climate Care, it seems to be a non-profit making sustainability consultant based in Oxford, who basically help, I don't think they actually do it, but they just help organise and advise tree planting schemes in Tasmania, or stopping companies burning bad things and burning sustainable things like coconut husks instead in far-flung parts of the world. And it's, I mean, clearly these are good projects that are being supported, but I don't know. I think we're used to the whenever we book a flight with EasyJet or wherever online, a little button comes up, says, you know, do you want to pay an extra fee, whatever it is, here to offset your air miles or your carbon footprint or whatever. And it's becoming a bigger and bigger thing. This may not even be the first initiative of its kind in the plant hire industry, but it's the first time I've heard of it. Plant hire company offering construction companies the opportunity to pay more for their plant. Now, personally, good luck to them. I mean, you keep using the phrase greenwashing, which I'm sympathetic to. It's the slight, their carbon footprint would be reduced an awful lot more if they used other kinds of machinery, less polluting machinery. That said, in defence of modern machinery, it pollutes a lot less than machines did 10 years ago. The Euro emission standards and so on have moved on a long
way.
That's
true, yeah.
But what gets me is the idea that anyone might pay to assuage their green guilt when they're not yet paying enough to assuage, well, to invest in the safety technology that exists. The equipment manufacturers, the leading edge equipment manufacturers, have got all kinds of smart features which they offer as optional extras. They're optional extras because most customers aren't prepared to pay for it. Some customers are prepared to pay for them, only to find that their end user customer say, oh, don't send that 100-ton machine with all the whistles and bells, which is really, really safe because it costs more. Send me your cheap 100-ton machine, which is cheaper, and bugger the whistles and bells that might save a life. So, you know, it's this cliche that everyone says up that, you know, safety is our top priority. No, it's not. If safety is your top priority, you would have that machine with hazard detection all around it, with cameras all around it that project images in the dashboard and whistle when anyone comes close. You wouldn't use open cabbed site dumpers. You'd only have the site dumpers with the full safety cabs. If you are not using state-of-the-art machinery, which is the safest machinery is available from manufacturers, then de facto, safety is not your top priority, folks. You can only claim safety is your top priority if you are prepared to pay for all these extra features.
Yeah, well, I must admit, I hadn't thought of that, but you're quite right. If people are unprepared to pay for the safety add-ons, then are they really going to pay to offset their carbon footprint? You mentioned the phrase greenwash, and I think this is probably a good example of greenwashing. I'm sure it's done with all the right intentions.
Best of intentions. I have nothing against Ardent for doing it. Best of
absolutely.
Intentions.
But I think it is a way of... Somebody in the marketing department can say, yeah, we can put that on our website. And, you know, we are a green builder because we've offset our carbon emissions by hiring from Ardent Hire Solutions.
And when we pitch for a project, we get sustainability points.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that counts for something these days.
It does. I mean, you're in business.
Yeah, absolutely.
What matters is that you win business by being sustainable, not that you're saving the planet. To the business, no. I should say. Of course it matters you're saving the planet. But the real motive is that you win business by saving the planet.
Yes, quite.
But I would repeat that I in no sense accuse Ardent here, so much as the whole world of carbon offsetting. Ardent have a lot of state-of-the-art machinery. They have a much younger than average fleet, because they're much younger than average firm, apart from anything else.
That's true.
So they are the good guys in terms of having clean, modern machinery, it goes.
Yeah.
David, I think that wraps it up for another week. We've probably entertained people for long enough for one morning's chatter, and it's getting mighty warm. I kept my office window shut in case any noisy vehicles came trundling past. For another week of reconstruction, we will be back next week. Thank you for listening. As usual, please contact us, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review on any of the podcasty type places that gives you the opportunity to leave a review. Give us a badge or a gold star or whatever they let you do, please. And we will be back next week. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing. We're currently offering a massive 80% discount on subscriptions to the Construction Index magazine. Order yours online today for only £1 per issue. Visit theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine to subscribe.